Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by David Sillitoe, media and arts correspondent at the BBC. David has covered the arts for more than a decade, reporting first for BBC News and then Newsnight. Media was added to his brief in 2013, and since then he has covered many of the industry's biggest stories, including big changes at the BBC itself, such as the appointment of Rona Fairhead, and government negotiations over the BBC charter. David, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, a pleasure.
So David, I used to listen to Radio York when I lived there, and I gather that that's where you started your career.
I did the London College of Printing postgraduate radio journalism course, and my first job, well, it was actually in a little attachment, was for 3 weeks with Radio Derby, in which I did absolutely nothing. They didn't allow me anywhere on air.
And you must have made the tea.
No, not even that. I don't remember. Maybe I did make one cup of tea while I was there, but absolutely nothing happened. And at the end, I was taken aside by the news editor, and he sat me down and he said, "David, you're utterly hopeless. Give up journalism. Give up now." And I thought, what am I going to do? And I rang up various different radio stations, and Radio York was one of them. And then I went away for 3 weeks on holiday thinking it was all over. And I got a call the day I came back, and they said they had 3 or 4 days of freelance work. And it just went from one day to the next to the other. And from day one, I knew exactly what I wanted to do, because the first story, the news editor looked at me with sudden glee and handed me this moth-eared press release and said, "Okay, do this." And it was the launch of the Can't Wait card by the York and District Colitis and Crohn's Disease Group.
Can't say I'm aware of them.
Well, when you are suffering from colitis and Crohn's disease, you are caught short at a matter of urgency. So I had to go round the shops of York discussing the toilet arrangements and whether or not they would accept the Can't Wait card. And this was their test for a young reporter. Can you make a piece that could go out on the BBC Radio York breakfast programme and it be acceptable? And that's how I managed to last until the next week. And I was on a two-week trial, and there was one other person. I won't mention his name. And he and I vied for various different stories. And it came to the last day and they said, one of you is going to get your job and the other one will go.
Oh, it's like an episode of The Apprentice.
It was terrifying. And he was sent out on a big story that morning. And he took the radio car and he drove to it. And it was not quite sure what had happened, but there had been a drowning in the River Ouse, police cordon. And so the mid-morning programme said, "Such and such is there in the radio car. Can you hear us?" And he responded by going, "Yeah, I can hear you. I can hear you. I'm not getting anywhere close. I have no idea what's going on. This is completely useless. This whole day's a disaster. I don't know how to use the equipment. I don't know what's going on. I don't know who these people are." There was some swearing. And then he realised
he was on air.
He'd managed to make the radio car work and was on air. And
I'm laughing, but obviously that's terrible.
And for everybody, he survived. His career did not come to an end that day, but it wasn't at Radio York. And I was desperate that day, and I rang everybody I'd spoken to over the previous 2 weeks, and there was a union convener called Ken Capstick, who I rang up at Stillingfleet Colliery, and he said, "Sorry, can't talk to you, David. We've just gone on strike." And that was my moment.
Because obviously that was the very moment that you did want to.
It was just perfect.
I suddenly
said, they're all on strike in the Selby coalfield, or at least they are in Stillingfleet. It was a fairly common occurrence back 25 years ago. But yeah, that's how I got my job.
Did you always want to be airside, as it were? Obviously, you studied broadcast, so there was never a temptation to be on the kind of behind the mic, the production side.
Many people are inspired by reporters they've seen and wanted to do that. My great inspiration was I loved Look North.
Was Harry Gratian presenting then?
Oh, this is even before Harry Gratian. There is a time before Harry Gratian. This was people such as Khalid Aziz was presenting in those days.
Wow.
And the man who impressed me most was he did the Anne Finally's, a man called Jeremy Cook. And he had a way about him that I thought, I loved his pieces. And I was inspired by news that showed you something of the world, but talk to you as if you're a human being. Mm. There was a nod and a wink. You were a person in on the joke, or you were a person who was being talked to, not addressed like a public meeting. And I didn't really know it at that time, but that was my inspiration. I suddenly thought, that is incredibly powerful, engaging. And a reporter, when I moved down to Plymouth, he took me aside one day and he said, David, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to report. I want to do the 2.5 minute report. It's what I think I'm quite good at and what I love doing. And he said, do it. Don't try and do a career by doing other jobs thinking you're going to get to that job. If you're going to report, report. Enjoy each one and don't care who employs you, but carry on doing it. It was the best advice I ever had.
Did you have any designs on whether it might be television or radio? And did you have any ultimate aims in terms of topics that you might cover? Or did you always want to be a generalist? Was it just the thrill of being on air and reporting, as you say? Didn't really matter what it was about, as long as there was drama and it was an interesting story.
What's really important is it a story? There are many, many facts that are posing as stories in that you can say them in 10 seconds and you think, where do I go now? What really matters are the things that you go home and someone says, what did you do? And you say, oh, I was doing this. And if you see a moment where their eyes slightly widen going, can you tell me the real story? That's when it's important. And it doesn't really matter what it is. All stories follow the same pattern. The arc is there is something interesting, people have got something to say about it, and there is a resolution. You begin, middle, end. They're all the same. They have to follow that pattern. And you tell it with sound, you tell it with pictures, and as little commentary as possible. The more the reporter gets out of it, always the better the piece is. I'm not following the views of everybody in this building, but for most of the time, you're watching television or you're listening to radio, and it's when real voices, real conversations, when you feel something authentic is happening, that's when you suddenly light up. No one ever comes to me the day after and goes, David, what a brilliant script line you wrote there. Yeah. I've never been told that in 25 years. What they say is, I love that woman in your piece.
Yes.
Or he was really, I can't believe what he said. And what that is, that's usually been 2 hours of me getting to know people and working with people and finding the other side of the story. And that's the magic. The magic is going out. It's getting in the car, getting on the train, meeting people, and gradually something magical will happen and you'll find something. I did a piece only a few weeks ago, and it was about an artist called Ben Johnson. He does photorealist paintings. He spent 18,000 hours, I think, on one painting.
On one painting.
And he has had assistants, and he added up all the hours, but it was extraordinary. He said it was essentially 10 years of work on one painting. And we talked and talked, and then suddenly he said to me, I suppose it goes back a bit to my childhood. I said, well, what happened in your childhood? And he said, oh, I had a slightly difficult father. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, oh, he was, I'll tell you about this night. I was a 9-year-old boy and I was lying in bed and suddenly I was shaken awake by my father. And he said, Benny, don't worry, but I'm going to kill your mother. And that's when his mother grabbed him out of the bed and they ran from the house. And he came back the next day saying every window in the house had been smashed. And he said, so I live a very solitary, very quiet, putting everything back together sort of existence. And he said, I think it must have something to do with that childhood, surely. And you went, oh, my goodness, it made magical radio. But that took 2 hours of talking. So most of the time you're rushing in and rushing out thinking, I know the story beforehand. Here, do the sound bites, get out again. And it's a bit dead. It's a bit sterile. The magical moment comes when suddenly people unfurl in front of you and you go, ah.
Is there a kind of hit of adrenaline that you get when someone says something as kind of, you know, eyebrow raising as that captures the attention where you think, wow, this really is a story, and you're kind of hearing it for yourself the first time, but then you're thinking as a journalist, how am I going to communicate this to the wider world?
Your story completely changes suddenly in a second. You can hear it if you're doing television and it's a quiet room and your cameraman is good. You can hear the little sort of, and you realise They've focused in. They've zoomed in a little bit. Suddenly, they're seeing something and they're aware of something. And suddenly, your cameraman has woken up. And you think, oh, goodness, the story's completely different. I'm going to need different pictures. I'm going to need different people to talk to. But it's the excitement. That's the moment when you think, oh, this will make a great story. When someone does something unexpected. I mean, I'm talking about art stories because that's what I've done. There was one, we did one about a ballet in Birmingham. Ballet is a tough subject to get on the television and on the radio, especially on the radio. It's difficult. I think that's the only way of describing it. The wonderful Dame Gillian Lynn was putting on a ballet that she had first performed in back in the 1940s. And it was lovely. And then I suddenly said, Dame Gillian, you're in your late 80s. How do you keep so active? She said, well, I do my morning routine. I have two metal hips and I've had a knee replacement. And then suddenly she got on the ground and she suddenly said, I do these exercises. And we just carried on. And we were doing it for television and for radio. And she suddenly said, now I want everyone over the age of 80, when they do a sit-up, make sure that your nipples are pointing to the sky and your crotch is open. And anyone other than someone in their late 80s...
You couldn't say that.
But suddenly she said, you've got to be careful. After a certain age, your crotch will close like a shed door in winter. And I thought, Radio 4, the Today programme, that's all we require. It's done. The morning is done and everything else can be hung on it.
They love all that stuff.
Those magic moments when something unexpected or real or authentic happens, and that's when you know that people at home and on Twitter, I look at it with fear. Twitter is a terrifying thing because all it is people going, do you know, they made a mistake, and they love it to point it out immediately. So it's immediately terrifying. I did a piece about post boxes and I kind of thought, I know I'll have got my Penfold confused with my Liverpool Standard or Liverpool Special or one of these things. But
and
then
crucified.
You see a little comment. Yeah. But it's also fantastic in that, you know, tone and feeling. People get back to you and say, I didn't like what you said there. Or that was a bit, it came across as a bit sarcastic. And I thought, oh, gosh, I didn't intend it that way. But you immediately have this feedback loop, which you've never had before. And it's from people who really matter. They're at home listening to it.
Where do you get your stories from? Because I imagine there's lots of sources. You know, stuff happens to the BBC, so you have to stand outside this very building that we're recording in, your broadcasting house, and say, kind of report on what's happening. But there'll be your contacts, there'll be stuff you'll dig out. What's the kind of on the pie chart of where you would get an average story from? What's the kind of ratio?
I asked that when I was at the London College of Printing many years ago. Where does news come from? And everyone laughed. You know, at the end of my 6 months of training, where does news come from? And I said, they all laughed and they didn't give me an answer. And to this day, I'm not really sure where it does come from. There are a mountain of press releases, 90% of which essentially go unread.
Can I apologise on behalf of the PR industry that I work in for wasting your time with all of those press releases?
Do you know what? 10% do get read and 1% become magic. And often they're a start to a conversation. And I have nothing against the PR industry. They perform a role, a valuable role, and it's a matter of communication and dialogue. And if you're taken in by spin, you're an idiot. You haven't asked enough questions. Of course they're going to be doing it. But then you'll have a conversation that will lead to something magical. And a lot of my stories, there was one I did with the British Library, and we were talking about, oh, it was some boring exhibition. I shouldn't say it, should I? But it was really boring. And we chatted and chatted and chatted. I said, this should be really interesting. And then I said, well, you know, the man who put it together, he does a sort of survey of pronunciation. And you know how many words are changing and certain young people, so mischievous or mischievous or says or says, or the one that really got people going, H. Or H. What do you do?
I use H because my mum would slap me if I said H. It's her pet hate.
See, everyone has. I did a little piece about that. It just went everywhere. It went absolutely everywhere. There was a conversation with a PR where we talked and we talked and we talked. Their exhibition was mentioned because it was the part of it. But we had something where we went out and we chatted to people and they arguments and the rows that happened as I would, you know, say, can you pronounce this word? And he went, if you know, if I had not spent 20 minutes chatting and talking about this press release, what's interesting, I think there's something good here, then, you know, we wouldn't have got anywhere near there. But, you know, I do chats also with PRs every now and again. There was one group of arts PRs representing museums and galleries, and they said, how do we get on the 10 o'clock news? And I had a think about that. And I said, well, you do know what the 10 o'clock news is. It's pretty much the 9 worst things that have happened in the world today.
Presented by Hugh Edwards. I think that's how they introduce it, actually.
Yeah. And if you want your organisation to be one of the 9 worst things that have happened
in
the world,
set fire to the building or something.
Great. We'll have you on. But other than that, you've got to be aware that probably it's going to be pretty tough unless something really extraordinary has happened. We want to get art stories on all the time, but they've got to have something that you'd want to talk about. They've got to have something that relates to the wider human condition. Because what they are is a fantastic way about talking about the way we live, who we are, with a different sort of texture. Because most news stories do follow a terrible, boring old rhythm of, you know, he said this, she said that, here's a row, someone's resigned. And you just go, oh, you know, how many millions of those have I watched in my life? But an art story can ask questions from a different sort of angle, with a different sort of tone, that can talk about things that are much, much harder to put your finger on, but the things that really matter. David Bowie dying. He was so much more than a musician, because it was a way of talking about clothes, what it is to be a man,
gender identity, sexuality, the whole lot.
All of these things. And you think about how many people in the 70s, 80s, 90s said, oh, my influence from music to typography to everything, oh, Bowie. Because he was like this little window on an alien world of things changing. Whether or not he was a reflection of those changes or an instigator of those changes, he represented a moment when Britain certainly changed. So, you know, that was what the excitement was about. But again, you know, it's an obit about a person. I didn't really care about the person. People will complain about the amount of Bowie coverage. But it's also a window to talk about how we've all changed.
But on the day that David Bowie died, for example, I imagine that you had a few stories that you were going to cover, you planned to. But obviously your media and arts correspondent at the BBC, a significant death like that, who is both a significant figure in the media and arts world as a musician, you must have to kind of throw that all out of the window. And then I imagine you've got News Channel wanting you to kind of do 20 minutes on air to kind of fill in where they can get other stuff. You've got your own obituary and your own packages to put together for the programmes. I mean, it must be a kind of nightmare for you if something really big happens in your world.
Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. When Paul Newman died, I was rotating my garden. I was covered in soil. I was covered in sweat. I could feel my phone vibrating in my pocket. I took the phone out. Someone said, Paul Newman's dead. I said, it's okay. I've done a pre-prepared obituary. I told them where it was. And they said, oh, hang on a sec. And then the next person said, so David, can you put Paul Newman's life into some sort of context? And I thought, hang on a sec. That's Peter Sisson's voice.
So you knew straight away, your gut feeling is, I'm on air.
There is a moment, it happens so quickly. When Robin Gibb of the Bee Gees died, 11:30 at night, I was ironing.
So it's not all glamour then.
It's not all glamour. And I picked up the phone and I tried to turn my iron off in the middle of the 12 minutes I was on air. You know, it's absolutely terrifying when these moments happen because they don't really want to hear what you have to say. What they're actually doing is using you to fill in time until someone really interesting comes along that they can get up on the phone line to actually have a chat to. I shouldn't give that away, but that's actually the truth about it. So you're there often filling in time. Thankfully, and this really is one reason why having a bit of experience helps, after a while, you have met and talked to a very large number of people. They have all told you something interesting, and you have some feeling about them as a real human being.
And that's all stored in the back of your mind, as it were, to be brought out while you wrote a bit.
Those anecdotes come out pretty quickly. You know, you just go, oh, have I met them? Though I did have a terrifying one when it was Jerry Lieber of Lieber and Stoller, songwriter. And they said, oh, he's died and we haven't got an obituary for him. And I said, okay, I'll do it. So I was in the edit suite. And amazingly, we had done an interview with him not that long ago, a few years ago. And so I watched the interview and it was quite good. But in the middle of a really good answer he was giving, someone butted in with one of those, you know, those little half questions and aren't questions, and then gave up halfway through. And I said, can you edit that out? Because he's really irritating. And my editor said, David, that's you. This was my interview with him. I have no memory whatsoever. You know, it pays to look back at everything you've done afterwards, but leave it a month.
One of the interesting things you just said then is about having the obituary pre-prepared. I mean, does the BBC have banks of thousands of obituaries for... I mean, the older they get, of course, the more likely they are to die, and therefore the more likely you are to have an obituary. But how does that work then? Do you have thousands of tapes in a vault somewhere for people both old and young with the obituaries pre-done? And isn't that a bit weird, recording the obituary or putting the material together when obviously they're still alive?
I have done one or two obituaries where I thought at the end of it, I'd really like to give them a call and bring them in and show it to them, because I'm sure they'd love to see it, because you've done it with real affection and this person means a lot to you and you know the world will miss them and you kind of want them to know, this is what we think of you. You are fantastic.
But you might also get a clock on the nose if they think you've, like, forgotten something.
There are one or two that, without doubt, I'm quite glad they're going to go out after the person has died. A bank of thousands? I don't know how many we have. There is no science behind it. Normally, if you hit the age of 80 and you have had a significant impact in British life of one form or another, especially in arts and entertainment, you get an obit. Because we sort of imagine that most people after the age of 80 have probably done the main things in their life. And we don't include in obituaries where you went for dinner last Wednesday or when you fell down the stairs. It's always the one or two things. The average length of them is about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. That's usually about four facts, of which one will be the concentration. It's much harder, of course, for people who've had incredibly multifaceted lives and done so much for such a long time.
To distill that into the same 2 minutes.
Very hard. It's much, much easier with people who did one amazing or shocking thing. And usually if they've also had a bit of a disaster as well in their lives. It's always good to have that ebb and flow of telling the story of somebody's life. But the complicated lives... They're tough ones. They're tough ones because you have to try and tell a story of a life. And everyone knows, oh, yes, it'll be that one thing that they did. But, you know, that's what it is. And it's enormously important for news. When Alan Rickman died, we had more than 1 million hits on our website within 4 minutes. 1 million hits on any story is a big
It's a significant amount
of traffic. 14 million hits on David Bowie's webpage when he died.
And is there a certain amount of pressure on you then, given that you'll be the face of the BBC reporting this, to kind of get it right and get the tone right as well?
Tone, more than anything. Of course, you've got to get the facts right, but tone is the essence of it. Because often people's lives are opaque at best. You know the facts that they presented. And then there's all sorts of other things there. And also, someone's just died. There's a family, there are relatives, and also very large numbers of people. Often, if you're doing an obit, you're normally doing it because people care about them. You have to have light and shade. You have to reflect the totality of their lives. But you have to present it in a way in which people feel comfortable with what you've told. And I think it's very much like being in a church and there's a funeral oration. You will say various different things, but you will err on the side of the good. And normally it's very, very easy. But, you know, I was about to mention one or two that I've done recently, but of course they're ones that have yet to go out. So let's not talk about that. But I also like to find one fact you didn't know about this person. I remember when Omar Sharif died and I included one that I thought was absolutely fascinating, Dr. Zhivago. Everyone knows Dr. Zhivago. Desolate, cold, Russian steppes, those incredible battle scenes. What I didn't know was it actually was filmed in the desert of Spain, and the snow is actually crushed marble dust. Wow. And he was there in all those furs in 40-degree heat.
Oh, poor bloke.
So, you know, if you include one fact like that, but most of the time, you're just trying to catch the mood. what was it about Omar Sharif? It's the fact that he was the most, he was the definition of charming and of debonair for a whole generation. And that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to work out, why is it this person? It's not just the list of roles or the list of awards. I try and avoid all that. It's trying to think carefully, going, why do people care?
How much has the kind of behavioural metrics that online news can give you changed your reporting? So, you know, back when you started out, you'd vaguely know how many listeners a show had or how many millions watched a certain news. But you wouldn't know, for example, now online, when you said Alan Rickman died, you knew exactly how many people had looked at it, what pages they'd looked at, what interested them. You can tell all that behaviourally. Does that kind of drive your coverage of it? Or is it too much information?
It's incredibly valuable information because not only do we know how many people, we know where people are from, and we get an idea of what time of the day. So you're getting information you've never had before. It is changing journalism hour by hour.
For the better?
Yes. But of course, it's not always in the same right direction. I think if you're immediately always trying to chase clicks, you're probably doomed because you will always be following a pack and you will not be coming up with the stuff. However, Professor Jeff Jarvis in America said it very clearly. He sort of said journalism is going from a shift from being essentially a product to a service. And I think the more we think of ourselves essentially delivering an information service to people, that's the mindset change that needs to actually happen. So if people want to know more and are clicking on all this stuff, we really have to pay attention to that. That's information that is coming real time that I think we should accept and go with. More often than not, it's throwing up bits of information that makes us just scratch our heads. Beginning of December. This is before Star Wars, but on the Arts and Entertainment's index of the BBC News website, by far the biggest story was the death of Scott Weiland. Now, you're giving me that look. Yeah.
I'm giving you the radio look because I was trying to, I don't actually know who he is.
Lead singer of the Stone Temple Pilots.
Ah.
I knew they were a band, I knew they existed, but it was way ahead of everything else. And we looked and we thought, how interesting. Has it not been reported by other outlets very much? Is there a massive fan base out there that we're not aware of? I'm still not quite certain why it was such a big spike, what was going on there. But there are all these things that bury into the fact that we don't really know much about our audience. I have this is my hobby horse. I call it the John Noakes effect. When John Noakes went missing on a Balearic island where he now lives, half our newsroom said, oh my goodness, this is a national tragedy if something has happened to John Noakes. And the other half went, I'm sorry, who is John Noakes?
Absolutely.
I hope people listening. He was a very famous presenter of a children's program called Blue Peter, and he did it for more than 10 years. And you ask anyone of my age, name a children's TV presenter, and they'll automatically go, John Noakes!
Absolutely.
For the next generation, completely meaningless. How do you tell stories with any degree of texture or nuance in 2 minutes when you have no idea what the shared knowledge is? I haven't got a clue. I haven't got a clue sometimes with these. I did a Vox Pop in Camden, teenagers, and I played them Yesterday by the Beatles. 9 out of 10 didn't know the song, didn't know it was the Beatles.
Incredible.
And you go, right, Yesterday, the most covered song of all time. There's no way you could play that or make any assumptions. To start off by saying the Beatles, a well-known pop group from the 1960s that transformed, you think, where do we go? I mean, there was...
Plus, that would annoy a lot of listeners that were thinking you were patronising them, because they would assume everyone would know who the Beatles were.
And, you know, but this applies to all forms of journalism. The economics unit here, they did a bit of research recently. Did they need to explain quantitative easing every time they mentioned it? So they did a bit of work with audiences. Yes. Absolutely.
Well, I want my listeners to hear no from me because I want them to think I'm clever, but the reality is, of course I do, because I still don't quite know what it is now.
And then they asked another question and they got to inflation. And actually, they need to explain that because people were going, inflation? And they're immediately thinking, interest rates? What? So what? So you realise how much explanation needs to go on to actually reach people. And you can't do it. You can't do it in a minute 45 piece if you're going to say anything about what's actually happened today. And the other big problem is shared experience. What do we have a shared experience of? 40 years ago, most people, well, 50 years ago, let's say, most people had experiences of being in the armed forces together. They worked in factories. They all were members of unions. There are all these mass parts of life that have disappeared. So one question is, why are there so many stories about the BBC? Well, it's one of the few things that almost everyone still has in common. More than 95% are consuming BBC product. So that's one reason why there's so much in the newspapers about the BBC, because you put Fiona Bruce's face there and everyone knows who it is. Put a pop star there and they really are disappearing from the newspapers really rapidly. Most of the people go, I need to read the caption. Oh, yeah. And the other thing about it, pop stars don't need the newspapers anymore. Beyonce went 3 years without doing a single interview. It's a changing world out there.
And do you think journalists are having a tougher job just plying their trade now? Because like you say, Beyonce can cut out the mainstream media and communicate with their fans via Twitter and Instagram. You've got newsrooms that are being cut up and down the country with fewer and fewer journalists. Here at the BBC, there's fewer and fewer people, but in any commercial operation as well. When Jeremy Vine did this podcast, he was saying when he started on his local paper at the start of his career, there were like 70 people in the newsroom and now there's like four.
When I started, one of my friends went to work in independent local radio. The newsroom had 23 journalists in it. It now has one. And they're reading the news, and that's all they're doing. It's absolutely terrifying if you look at legacy media. The people producing the print, producing the old style radio, it's been a torrid time. And that style of journalism is really, really being challenged. Because what happens is that the more you cut back, the less coverage, the less you can actually go out, the less you can come up with the stories that will actually get some interest going there. So it's a vicious circle that's around there at the moment. But I have to say, this is a magical time for journalism. I am reading more and better journalism every day of my life than I've ever done before. I would have had to have spent hundreds of pounds on magazines to stay across the amount of stuff that I stay across at the moment. You know, you look at long form, you look at Medium, you look at Flipbook, you look at all this stuff, and I'm there on my way back and forth from work. And it's a cornucopia of material. 60,000 podcasts, of which this is the greatest, I hear.
Thank you, David.
You know, it's absolutely amazing. I spend an awful lot of my time listening to, you know, one or two American podcasts. Radiolab. Have you ever listened to Radiolab?
Do you listen to Serial?
Serial. You know, it's magical. Absolutely magical what's happening at the moment. It's just where you are and who's paying your mortgage at the moment. If you're in the right place and it's growth and they found a business plan, this is the best time to be a journalist, because the tools that are available to you, the ability to do sound and vision and tell stories in with a depth and texture that we've never had before, is there at your fingertips. And it's so easy to do in a way that it wasn't a few years ago. And, you know, if you find the right story, it'll go mammoth. It can go around the planet within seconds. But the day-to-day in the normal newsroom, absolute nightmare. And, you know, I have so many friends in journalism, and very demoralising, very demoralising.
It must be an incredible privilege, though, to work for the BBC, given, you know, you do have resources, you've got access to a strong audience, and the trust in your journalism instantly. I mean, when Torrin was doing your job, I paid tribute to him when we interviewed him for this podcast when he was in post, and I said, one of the best things about the BBC for me is that even when the BBC's in crisis, the most trusted source of news on that for me to turn to is the BBC. And I can't think of a higher compliment to the integrity and standards of the BBC's journalism.
It's also terrifying. Make a mistake and it's there, magnified, multiplied. And also everyone is reading in every conspiracy that could possibly be there as to why you've said that particular thing at that particular time. Normally it's because it's the one fact that popped into my head at that particular moment.
But people leap straight to conspiracy rather than tiredness and that you've not had a coffee.
Of course. And that goes with the territory. But it's a massive, massive privilege. But also, you know, stories happen and you see things happening and you think, should we have this on air? And you're going, have we got the extra source? How absolutely certain are we? So sometimes we can watch a story, going on for half an hour, and yet we are 90%. Should we go? No, let's not. Let's. And then you finally can go with a story. And it looks like we've been hanging around, not doing anything, trying to ignore a story, when actually it's been that terrifying, frantic moment when you go, this person's saying it. Are we absolutely certain? Twitter, a nightmare. When people die, not only are they now having repeated deaths, where again and again they seem to be dying, the number of hoax stories that come up, or people hear a rumour, and you think, oh, how do we do it? How do we verify this story? Because some people, the process is straightforward. Others, you know, Patrick McNee
from the Avengers.
Steed, you saw it on one report on Twitter. And eventually I managed to find the coroner's office in America, west coast of America, just woken up. And we went through it. And of course, his name was slightly different. And he said, oh, yes, we have a McNee. He did die yesterday. Extraordinary. And then he said, so who is this person? I said, oh, it's, you know, Steed from the Avengers. And he said, oh, I know this man. But I also watched The Avengers. I had no idea who he was. And he was absolutely startled when he said, oh, my goodness, this is extraordinary. But that was an hour and a half of ringing around to find this one office and this one person. And
is he dead?
But there again, it does mean that, you know, certain other broadcasters, I'm not going to name any names, but I once did watch 20 minutes of rolling coverage of the death of somebody and they weren't dead.
Wow. How does it work in terms of breaking news then? Do you have a kind of playbook of shows that will bid for you? Do you think, right, okay, this person's died, so I'm going to have to do The 10, then The World Tonight, and then do something for the midnight news and prep something for today? And then do you kind of field calls from other areas of the BBC, like the Jeremy Vine show? How does it work? Do people bid for your time? And how do you decide what you're going to do?
Sometimes it's the first bit of broadcast that gets hold of you and you go, oh, yes, I'll do that, before you actually had time to think about it. The normal run is you would go to the BBC News Channel first, or if 5 Live gets you and you're in a position where you can do it on the phone, break it on 5 Live. So we have the two breaking news outlets. Often with a story, it's a matter of there's a radio person and a television person. So one of your editors, I have a boss, and also there are people who are in charge of the daily news resources. We'll say, David, do the news channel. Other person, run upstairs and do 5 Live. So we do the breaking news. And then there is the debate about who does the cut pieces that go on the bulletins. So that can be a debate and discussion, often heated.
So do you prepare like a package and then sell it round where you think, you know, 5 Live will want to take it, but not if Radio 4 PM want it? Does that happen? Does it come to blows?
Officially, I should say no. It can be very difficult in that everyone wants to be first, everyone wants to have something exclusive, everyone wants to say something that the others aren't saying, and if it's one person doing it all, there can be some delicate negotiations as to actually what happens. More often than not, it's more accident than design, exactly what actually happens. When the 1 o'clock news, for instance, goes out on air at 1 o'clock, it's quite a good day when there are more than 3 pieces that have actually been completed by the time you go on air. The edits are all going on 6 o'clock news.
As exactly the show's already on air.
Yeah. So you normally think it's a good day if you've managed to get it on the server 4 minutes before it goes to air.
So the adrenaline's going, if something goes wrong, you don't have any time to correct it. And that must sharpen the senses and make it work. Because I'm actually better when I'm live. If I've got the chance to re-record something, that usually means I will cock up more often than not. Whereas if I'm actually on air and I can't cock up, I usually don't. Is that the same for yourself?
Absolutely. There are two different mental states. And I notice that with a lot of people, that when they're on air, they seem to switch. And their ability to be articulate, to find the right word, to be a broadcaster completely changes. And other people, it's the other way around. They go to pieces when they're live. So it depends what adrenaline does to your system. I like putting together the TV package. But being on air, there is a thrill as well. But I think sometimes we make a fetish of it in that we enjoy being live. I don't know whether people at home really care particularly one way or another. When you see a live Aston going up there, unless something is really unfurling in front of you, do I really care if this man standing outside a building is saying it now or was saying it half an hour again?
I mean, at least Scotland Yard has that revolving sign. But I think, why is the journalist even stood there? Because the coppers are out actually on the scene dealing with it. Nothing's happening there. It's just a backdrop, isn't it, really?
These are thoughts that have crossed my mind, but I can't comment on them because that's above my pay grade.
But isn't it better to be in the studio and kind of talk to the anchor on air? I mean, one of the things is, particularly if you're on television, is if you're on the 10, you've only got 3.5 minutes, really, or even less. And it's, you can't just have a normal conversation. Hugh's got to ask you 2 or 3 very pointed questions. You've got some pre-prepared answers and then you're off.
It's tough to get it right. It really is tough. And there are people who get it. And, you know, I look back at certain masters. I remember Andrew Marr when he was the political editor, and he had an ability to essentially come up with a phrase, a thought, just something that struck you, and it stuck in the mind. And I think that's where I would head towards as being the sort of the gold standard of what you need to do. What is the one thought you want to take away from today and this particular story that is going to be talked about in the pub afterwards? And if you can get that, you know, it's essentially the telling detail, the little special thing.
One question I'd like to ask you as a media journalist, but also as a BBC person and a BBC media journalist, is charter renewal, because everyone seems to think in the public that the BBC is over-resourced and that cuts need to be found. But the minute any manager starts to suggest a specific programme or a channel like Six Music, obviously people are horrified, because then they think, oh no, I don't want specific things to be cut because that's brilliant. What do you think is going to be the manifestation of the kind of reduced financial income that the BBC is going to have, you know, paying for the extra TV licences, all of the kind of various cuts? Where do you think that the cuts are actually going to land?
There's a big question.
And you're the most qualified person in the world to answer it.
I wish I was. someone maybe listening to this might be able to tell me some answers that I don't know yet at the moment. Two parts to the question. The first one is about the BBC and cuts. And I think many people, there's quite a good analogy. There was some research done that I was quite interested in. How interested are people in the arts? And the percentage of the population who said they had any interest in arts news was 11%. It was right at the very bottom. And that's because of the word the arts. And they hear ballet, they hear opera, they hear stuff that they don't go and see or do. But everybody, and I really mean everybody, has something that they have a passion about. And if they heard something about it, they'd immediately turn on. But they would go, oh, I'm not interested in the arts per se. So people might say, oh, the BBC, and they hear an institution. They hear, oh, what story they've just read in the newspapers or something about that. But then they'll have some bit of output that they really care about. And that's what the BBC tries to do. It tries to provide something that really matters to everybody. So they'll not think of Radio 2, for instance, as being the BBC. They'll think, oh, I love Chris Evans in the morning, he makes me laugh, and never really sort of think, oh, it's the BBC. So when you go cuts, they go, ah, yes, it's just faceless bureaucrats being got rid of, as I'm all in favour of that, but not my programme, not what I love. Or if you rely on the website in some way, or you like a local radio station, or all of these sorts of things. And, you know, Six Music tried to close it down. What did they do? They doubled his audience. Someone once said, if you want to have a marketing program, that's what we ought to do. Go around each bit and say we're going to close it, and then we'll see if we can double the audience.
Yeah, but with some shows, there'd quite rightly be a riot if you threatened to close it. Maybe we should close the shows where people are too polite to riot, like maybe The Archers. I mean, there'd be a few kind of sternly worded letters to The Times and The Telegraph, but there won't be riots in the streets if we cancel The Archers. I mean, we could spend that money on something else, surely.
Do you know where you're sitting?
In the studio that's recorded.
Not quite. But I'm sorry, if you even touched a second of The Archers, you do not know of what you speak, I'm afraid. I have seen people reduced to jelly by the Radio 4 audience when they're angry. It's very, very hard to change anything on these outputs because people, it's the rhythm of their day. And radio is so intimate. It's so a matter of something, a friend who's with you, that you change something, move something around and go, but I do that before I pick up the kids or I one of my favourite things was Roger Wright, who used to be the head of Radio 3, and he talked about Lake Junction, which is a programme they have late at night, about 11 o'clock. And he said, you know what that's all about? He said, everybody has a pottering time. You've put the kids to bed, you've done the washing up, you've turned the television off, but you just poodle about a bit. And he said, I wanted a radio programme for people and that bit of pottering. You're still listening, but you're just doing those various little final things of the day. And I thought, it's when you start thinking like that, you're interfering with people's pottering time. You don't want to go anywhere near that. These are deep things in people's lives. But I think a big challenge for the BBC is how fast things are changing elsewhere. Landmark dramas, the amounts being spent on it. Suddenly you realise you have to raise the game. One of the really, really interesting things that I was noticing recently was how much BBC comedy from the 70s can still be repeated. But you can't repeat any of the drama. The production values.
It's just terrible.
Just don't stand up. You realise what we got away with. Studio-based drama, I mean, and they closed down Television Centre. Someone said, isn't it terrible, all those fantastic studio-based dramas they did in TV Centre, not realising that the last time we used a studio for drama was 1993. Comedy is forgiving so long as it's funny. That's all that matters. Drama, the second you see that a slight little wobble, the sense of the lighting changed, people just go, ooh.
And why do you think that is? Because an audience in a theatre would obviously be aware it's on the stage and forgive an imperfection or two. But why are your audiences watching television drama so unforgiving?
It's because once you're in the theatre, you've paid your money, you're not going to go quickly. And also, you've acknowledged it's all about the suspension of disbelief. The thing in television is, easier and easier every day, just to click from something else to something else, and it just requires that little moment when you just go, oh, and you're over. And drama has to really, really draw you in, suck you in. You've got to care about the characters, but also the second you look something that's been a bit cheap, not very well done, a bit 1970s, you just think, I no longer have faith in this in the same way.
I mean, I've asked this a couple of times of other guests, but one of the things that I suppose the BBC are always damned if they do and damned if they don't is that whole balance of creating populist stuff, The Voice, Sherlock, all of these kind of things that people watch in their millions and hugely enjoy, and the kind of programmes that appeal to niche audiences where, that's maybe what the BBC should be focusing on. And could you cut The Voice? Could you cut Sherlock? Because although you're doing it well, does the BBC have to be doing these things? And couldn't the commercial sector make Sherlock just as equally as good?
Interesting in that, let's talk about comedy. Name me a successful comedy over the last 15 years not made by Channel 4 or the BBC.
I don't know. That's a good question.
David Abraham, boss of Channel 4, he said, our remit is to do comedy. He said, comedy loses money. And they've produced some fantastic comedies, even back to Father Ted onwards.
Love Father Ted. I would even watch The In-Betweeners over the Christmas period.
I can watch The In-Betweeners over and over again.
It's appalling. I loved every second of it.
It's genius.
It is genuinely genius.
Utter genius. But for every comedy you have that's a hit like that, you have 10 failures.
Mm.
It's just not commercial. Why it's so, so hard to come up with good comedy. And you look at comedies that we now consider absolutely part of the schedule. You couldn't imagine them without the BBC. And you realise they had the first 2-3 series.
No one watched it.
No one watched it. Monty Python went out at 11 o'clock at night on BBC Two. Nobody was watching it. Afterwards, we imagine, oh, yes, of course.
But the commercial world is just too brutal. They'd have to can it on season one because no one was watching it and they've got to make money from season one onwards.
And I think one of the most interesting arguments has been about the weird ecology of British television. We have a weird, weird ecology. We have a state broadcaster. Well, a state-owned broadcaster that is independent in the BBC. But then we have another state-owned broadcaster that's commercial, which is Channel 4. what a weird thing for the government to own a channel like Channel 4. But it works. It sort of works. And then you've got public sector broadcasting independent channels. So they're told when to put the news out and what sort of programming they have to have. They're not, you know, ITV is not entirely at liberty to do exactly what it wants. And then you have this great mass of the complete free market. And you realize that each one feeds the other. And you have essentially, it's like the film industry. What you're wanting is a critical mass of writers, a critical mass of producers and of directors and of people with experience and people who can move from one to the other. They can try their experiments out. So the BBC maybe, you know, it's very much like Channel 4, a place for experiment, for trying out new things. And that's why I think the Britain has been so successful at formats around the world. We have this weird ecology. In America, you know, you listen to how they do it, you know, with the pilots that come at the beginning of the year, the decisions that are made. And then by September, you need to have made 26 episodes. You know, you realize how industrial the process is. HBO's changed everything because now they can do 6 episodes and they don't have to produce it all at the same time. They don't have to do a pilot. They can have an experiment. So that's completely transformed America. But there's so much more competition. The amount of scripted drama being produced in America has in the last 6 years doubled. The number of feature films. When I started 15 years ago talking about feature films, there was about 450 a year came out. Now it's about 950. There's just a deluge of fantastic material out there. The key thing is, you know, who are your people there to go out and say, here's the good stuff and present it to you at the right time of day. And I still think linear channels are absolutely central to that.
David, we've got a few minutes left of the podcast because we're running out of metaphorical tape, but what's next for you?
The future, I can't think of a better job. I don't want to say, I've said this out loud now, haven't I, that I've got the best job there is, but it really is.
I agree. I think you've got the best job in the world.
It is fantastic because there is the mix of the hard news, the frightening stuff, reporting on your colleagues, which can be very, very tense.
There must be awkward moments where you're at the water cooler, or you're walking down the corridor and someone you've just said doesn't have a clue or is worried or their speculation about their job is rife in government, and then you have to say, oh, hi, are you all right? You know, is that awkward?
What's extraordinary, and this is absolutely true, is that I've reported on the BBC over 10 years or so, more than 10 years actually. And there have been some dark moments, and there have been moments when there have been cock-ups. I have never had a single person come up to me and object to anything that I've said or express an opinion. The idea of Chinese walls seems a bit weird to people, but there is that sense that the BBC is the biggest cultural institution in Britain, bar none. It's the only thing, cultural institution, that almost everybody in some way or another dips a toe into. And you have to report on it. And you have to report on it as if you are standing outside. So I go to the press office. I treat it as if I am an external journalist all the time. And I try and, of course, make contacts as much as possible. Thankfully, most of the stories I do are not about BBC News. Mm. That is much more challenging.
It would be a bit meta, wouldn't it?
About being about BBC News. You know, but we've had our moments. Thankfully, I wasn't actually a part of the Newsnight report on Panorama's programme on a Newsnight report, which I think reached new layers of metaness in the middle of the Savile crisis.
I actually watched that for the metaness. I thought it was why I made it a point to watch. How is Newsnight going to cover Panorama's coverage of Newsnight?
It just becomes absolutely bewildering.
I thought they handled it very well, in fairness.
And nobody expresses opinions or, you know, you think there are going to be rows. You think there are people going to say you can't do this and you can't say that. I do my reports and I think, nobody's coming into the edit suite. No one's saying a word. They're just, it's terrifying because they know immediately they did it. I just tweet it. You know, so I am in a very privileged situation, but also you have to be mindful that you have to be treating it as if you are an outsider. And I always think to myself, my basic rule of thumb is, what would my mum have wanted to have seen on the television about this story? Knows enough about the background of most things, but what questions would she want asked? And if you start thinking like that way, then I think you're probably going to do just about okay or survive on a day-to-day basis. But the thing about it is, if you really want to know about the BBC, I always read Media Guardian first because they always seem to get it first. How they do it, I have no idea. And it absolutely frustrates me. But yeah, it's a quite a leaky organisation. I don't think I'm the first to have identified that yeah, all sorts of information gets out there. But you were talking about the future and where stories come from. The glorious thing is everything I plan is always thrown up in the air by something unexpected happening. I live to fight another day. That's what I normally say at the end of each report. I haven't been sacked. Fantastic. Let's go on to the next one. There's always something really interesting. And actually, I've got a story about rhubarb coming up in West Yorkshire. And I'm quite excited about that in the next week or two.
Well, I shall listen to that with interest. David, we've run out of metaphorical tape, but it's been hugely enjoyable. Thank you ever so much for your time.
A real pleasure. Thank you.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!